Welcome to your Right to Speak discussions on social justice and advocacy. This is episode 23. I'm your host, Salvatore, and Jen is on the phone with us today.
Hi, guys.
Today's episode, we'll be talking about anti-oppression with Ian, who I've heard great things about from our last guest. Ian, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. Hi, everyone. Thanks for having me. My name is Ian Pereira. I was born in Toronto, so I'm right from the city. I've seen it grow with all sorts of wonderful people, diverse people. I am of Portuguese descent. I'm a first-generation Canadian. I identify as a gay man, using the pronouns he and him. And, I guess we could talk about some of my studies. And in this particular area, my child and youth counseling diploma that I did about 12 years ago at George Brown. And I suppose I got into the field or the area of study because at that particular time in my life, I was sort of faced with some of my own challenges. And I explored the idea of learning a little bit more about what it meant to support young people, and it caught my interests, and I decided to pursue that, and 3 years later, I graduated. And I continued with my studies. However, I got a great opportunity from my current employment or employer to work in a mental health setting, a day program setting. And then I also had a really great opportunity to work in a hospital setting as well. And that was a child and adolescent psych unit. So it still was in the same sort of genre. So mental health and I have been doing this in this particular position for about the last 12 years. And I think I was at about 7 years or maybe 6 years at St. Joe's. And then I got another position with another hospital that focused on concurrent disorders. So again, with the same population. And concurrent disorders just meant that I'm working with young people who are struggling with a mental illness, as well perhaps struggling with addictions issues as well. And that was all really new to me. When I was working in the hospital setting, I could speak to that. We were finding that we were getting young people who were struggling with mental health issues. However, almost always there was an addiction component, and we were having to work with our young people and focus on the mental health issue, and then they would have to go to a completely new setting to then focus on the addictions piece. So fast forward, a few years, and they created this concurrent disorder program, and I was really excited about it, and I was very fortunate to get a position there, and really realized the gap in the system at that time. So I'm really proud of that position, and I'm really proud of this position as well, and I'm really proud of the young people who I'm supporting and who are receiving the or who are having the courage to come to get support. So that's a little bit about me, and like I said, so it's about like 12 or 13 years that I've been doing this now. I had a wonderful opportunity to teach at Humber College. So I was a prof there, so I did that for about a year and a half. Continuing to look for an opportunity to get back into teaching. However, what I'm finding is that it sort of gets in the way of my my position here at the clinic. So hopefully I'll get back in and help educate and have dialogue with young people who are also wanting to get into the profession as well.
Yeah. Sounds like you've done some great things.
Thank you. Yeah, I think so. One of the original, rebels and warriors out there.
Yeah. So I guess we should just dive into it.
Sure.
Was wondering if you could explain and describe what anti-oppression is, or what the framework is for the listeners.
Sure. So, okay, so anti-o. So, I mean, if we sort of, you know, look at our position in this world, mm-hmm. You know, we are born, we are, you know, bombarded with all sorts of messages every day, either from the people around us, from the rules that are set in place, from, you know, that are put in legislation, you know, from media. We are taught to look at things in a particular way. Mm-hmm. You know, we are conditioned to look at the world and to strive to be a certain kind of person. However, it often means that we're striving to be a certain kind of person that the world has told us that we should mm-hmm. be. So that, you know, we look at, you know, the whole world, and then the countries that are involved, and then the cities, and there are all sorts of rules, right, and legislations that are like policies that are put in place. And what happens is that these, you know, writings, policies, are usually a reflection of somebody else's ideas, right? Mm-hmm. So these values and beliefs, like, they're embedded in us. And so when people in power have these particular values and beliefs, they tend to write these policies based on their own experiences. Mm-hmm. So the problem is that their experiences may not reflect, you know, everybody else's experiences in the world, right? And what we know is that we come from a very diverse world, and I'm gonna like bring it in a little closer. And, you know, Canadian, and being Canadian, you know, the country is very diverse. Mm-hmm. So we have to reflect, you know, the fact that all of these rules were made by people, but not necessarily taking into account of the way that all of these wonderful, diverse people walk through life. So if we talk about racism, like homophobia, ableism, you know, which I like to say, people who are, you know, able and have the ability mm-hmm. to achieve things, you know, people who are older than us, they have things to say. People who are younger than us, they have things to say. And so, you know, when we try to walk through life and, you know, move forward and overcome barriers, some of these barriers are much more difficult for some people than others. Mm-hmm. And so I think anti-o is, you know, is about stepping back and reflecting on the privilege and the power that exists, and then how we fit into that. And are we heard? Have we exchanged ideas? You know, are you putting these policies in place, but it's reflecting who I am? Right. You know, is there equity in these decision making, you know, in making these decisions? So, yeah, I think that anti-o is just, you know, exploring the differences, the beautiful differences that we all have to bring to the table, and then listening to people, you know, people's experiences, you know, and recognizing our position. So
I think those are great points, and I'm currently doing my master's in public policy, and I think, you know, when you brought up the policy thing, it's so true that often, I guess, in my education, I mean, I have the CYC background, so I've been trained in anti-o, but mm-hmm. that's not really taken in like the policy realm.
Right.
I don't think we've ever had those. I mean, there's a class on equity and policy that we're taking, but right. you know, anti-o is a different type of mm-hmm. understanding. So I think that's a great point that you brought in that policy aspect, and hopefully my classmates that are listening to this
amazing
can take that on and understand the importance of Antio, because I do find it's missing in policy.
Right.
Quite a bit.
Correct. Yeah. Like, imagine that. Like, from a very young age, you know, I mean, you're doing your master's and there's value in education. Absolutely. And there are all sorts of wonderful things that are being taught and that we're learning. I mean, I'm part of that system, you know, when I'm doing courses and, you know, the studies that I've done over the years. However, you know, from a very young age, when we're learning about, you know, perhaps like a Eurocentric focus, you know, that's just one lens. You know, these are stories that we're hearing from like one perspective. It's pretty narrow. And so from a very young age, people are sort of ingesting this education and you know, and listen, there's room for it. But as a, like, if there was a person of color, you know, in the classroom, if there was a person who was part of the LGBTQ community, if there was a person with an ability, you know, does that curriculum reflect them? You know, was there ever, you know, some input, you know, in creating this curriculum from people who are marginalized, right? And that's where we have to sort of, again, about reflecting. Yeah. And that starts from a very young age.
For sure.
You know? And then, you know, so, and then we, again, and then, you know, so we're learning all of this information and we're walking through life. And then our decisions, we're making these decisions based on what we've learned. And then it's a system that continues to oppress these marginalized communities because there's no representation.
Yes.
You know, and how can I move forward, let's say, like, as a, like, you know, a young person of color, when I don't see people who look like me, or I'm not hearing stories about people who look like me, who have overcome. You know, there's all sorts of wonderful writing out there that reflects, you know, people of color and, you know, marginalized communities and people with disabilities, people who are older than us, people who are younger than us, you know? So those stories need to be told.
Yeah, no, for sure. And like, just to bring it back to the policy thing, often the excuse has been, oh, we have to be broad in general for the rest of the public. But I think using that as an excuse doesn't really allow for, you know, policy analysts to really consider all these other elements.
Right, right. And then how valid is that information? How valid is that information when, you know, when it's taught in our curriculum, but it's sort of going to contribute to the way that we grow up and make decisions.
Right.
But how valid is it when then I'm a contributing member to society who happens to be a gay man, yet, you know, I'm striving for things that don't reflect me, you know, that I'm trying to strive for things that are like heteronormative, all of these ideas, you know, it's putting me in a box when, you know, again, going back to Antio and listening to people's experiences, imagine that, imagine now, you know what, we're going to hear people's stories and experiences, and we're going to now include them in our policies where there's equity now. You know, there's an opportunity to include, you know, really wonderful stories of, you know, diversity across the spectrum, right?
I'm there with you.
Yeah,
you're
no,
preaching
absolutely.
To the choir.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Jen, I don't want to forget
quick
you.
Question.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm just thinking about it while you're talking. And I was just wondering, how often do you think these trainings should happen? Because I know we're given a certain viewpoint from a very young age, and it's not very inclusive, whether, you know, that's through, like, school or the media sometimes, and like you said, it's very Eurocentric. So I know, like, they offer these trainings, but I'm just wondering to combat, like, we're talking about years of messages kind of ingrained into us. And I don't know if I personally believe that one training, one time, is going to be effective for me personally.
Right. Well, I agree. I think it's an ongoing discussion. I think people need to feel uncomfortable. And what happens is feeling uncomfortable means that we're sort of tapping into a place in ourselves that allows us to question things. You know, so whether you agree with policy change and that, you know, that we should include, you know, stories and experiences from very diverse people or not, the mere fact that we feel uncomfortable allows us to, just think about what is happening for other people. And then, you know, with the hope that we then could have this dialogue, you know, why are people feeling uncomfortable? You know, I talk about, you know, privilege with a lot of people, and people get really defensive when I use that word. And I think that they think that that it sort of strips them of all of the struggle that they have gone through. And it sort of undermines, you know, the work that they've done to get to that place. And then, you know, it's and then we look at, like, what does that mean? So if I have this dialogue with a person about privilege and their position in the world, if we just based it on, let's say, you know, we're talking about people of color, you know, we talk about, you know, let's say a white male, because it even gets deeper than that, right? So like white, but then white, what, female? But I don't want to go off into that tangent. But let's say a white male who's worked really hard to get to where they're at, but has a difficult time sort of understanding and seeing that all of the opportunities that that person may have come across, and even though it was very difficult, because I never want to take away from people's experiences as well. However, we need to understand that it looks very different for a person of color. So the decisions that are made, so let's say, you know, we have, you know, a white male who decided to go to post-secondary school, who, you know, came from a family that had two parents. You know, they worked really hard to send their children to school, and then they you know, they get into that school. And then we take a person of color who, you know, for, you know, their family's experiences for generations has had a really difficult time. And we talk about, like, where they come from, you know, and how they need to get to that school, the money that it involves to get into that school. So that same opportunity, right out of the gate, there are many barriers that, let's say, a person of color would have to face as opposed to, you know, a person who was a white male, let's say, you know. So yeah, so it's about dialogue, and it's about feeling uncomfortable. And going back to your training, no, I don't think that one training is enough, you know. I think that it needs to start, you know, at the top. You know, I think what needs to happen is, you know, like executive directors, board members, you know, people who hold these positions of power need to be challenged so that they could sort of create a ripple in the system, because they're the ones making the decision, you know. And then, you know, with the hopes of, you know, getting people to come in and speak to employees, you know, changing curriculums in our learning institutions, you know, and then, you know, changes in institutions around the city, around the country, and then around the world. But it's the people at the top that hold these positions of power that really need to, you know, make that change or ignite that fire, essentially.
Right. Kind of putting it into practice more.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then it comes down to us, and then, you know, then it's a part of a policy, like in a social service agency, let's say. You know what I mean? Okay, guys, this is the road we're gonna go down. You know? So
yeah.
I think coming from the other way, if it comes from, like, let's say the bottom up, you know, that we could be challenged in what we do, but, you know, things need to change on paper. You know, like policies need to change, and that's really important. So I could work, you know, and you know, be an advocate for people, you know, diversity. However, yeah, like literature needs to change so that people then, you know, come into an agency, for example, and understand that it's in policy that this is the way that we need to work with people who are diverse, you know.
I agree. And I just want to bring it a little, like, just challenging the framework a bit now. So do you think, because, so the anti-O basically takes consideration, like, the other isms, right?
Or the
typical types
of
isms.
Yes, absolutely.
And do you think the framework should be further developed to consider, like, adultism, which is a new and up-and-coming term, or cultural humility instead of cultural competency?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I think there needs to be representation across the board. You know, again, so I'm very lucky to work with young people. These young people have wonderful things to say. Mm. People learn differently. They experience the world differently. Who am I, sitting in my position of power, to say what works for you or that one size fits all, right? I want to hear the feedback from young people so that I can include it in my practice. But even more importantly is that I could include it in my own philosophy of life. That I could inherit this thing and walk through life believing this stuff, genuinely believing this stuff, so that when I communicate with my friends, my family, people around me, that I could sort of communicate these new ideas in an honest and valuable way.
Yeah, like what you just said reminded me of it. So I used to work at the Advocate's office, and I was talking with one of my coworkers there about like the human rights framework.
Right.
And, you know, we have both agreed that it's really a way of being, a way of living. And it's the same type of thing that you're saying right now. You know, Antio is kind of a way of being and living. You don't just leave it at work, right?
It's, absolutely.
It should be in all aspects of your life.
Yeah. We need to believe it in our own lives for it to be effective. You know, and again, without repeating myself, but when I have these conversations with people who perhaps aren't fortunate enough to take a training or fortunate enough to work with diverse populations, you know, it's an opportunity to make people feel uncomfortable, you know, and not in a negative way, but maybe to tap into a place that they may not have thought about before. Because they're comfortable, right? We're all comfortable, essentially. You know, we walk through our lives and we learn what we learn, and maybe sometimes that's just enough. But that's also part of the problem, right? When we walk through life and we're ignoring what's happening around us, that's essentially going to ripple and affect us. It always does.
That's one of the great things that, you know, I liked about Humber so much in my education, because I came into the program not knowing about really white privilege and whiteness and all that stuff. And even though I'm part of, you know, different aspects of marginalized communities, I am still the white person. So I experience, you know, the marginalization very differently. And it's about, you're absolutely right, it's about feeling that uncomfortable. When I was first learning about it, I was like, what the hell? Like, what is whiteness? And what is this term? And
what does that mean? I worked hard to get here. Yeah. Like, you know, no one took care of me getting, like, I had to do everything, you know, on my own. And yeah, absolutely. But no, when you really step back and again listen to people's experiences, there's another door that opens up that allows you to think differently and reflect, and that's it. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we don't need to say anything. Sometimes all we need to do is just listen, you know, and it gets bigger than that. You know, the messages that we're getting from a very young age, you know, toys and who they're geared for, you know, very specific, gender specific. You know, if it's like a Tonka truck, you've got, you know, almost always white little kids. Dad is playing with, you know, his son or his sons, and they're playing trucks. And, you know, it's they're usually, you know, very masculine focused.
Yes.
You know, and then you've got on the other side, you've got then maybe like this, some sort of a house kit, you know, and then mom's playing with her daughters and this really soft music, and they're white too. And so these messages are all being, you know, sort of put out there, you know, and then without even realizing it, we're being conditioned to think a certain way.
And it's interesting that you bring up the toys, because I remember learning about, you know, in the, I don't know, 19th century, whatever, pink, the actual color pink was meant for boys.
Ooh.
So it's interesting how, you know, we've come, you know, to think that pink is just for girls.
Right. Well, right from birth.
Yeah.
If you're female, you're put in a pink blanket.
Right.
You know, and if you're male, you're likely to put in a blue blanket. So these are all, again, so messages, like, literally from birth, you know, that sort of influence the way that we think. And, you know, more importantly, to be part of a community that thinks the same way and to feel comfortable with those people, but then almost ignoring, you know, that there are different people that walk through the world that have wonderful things to say and to contribute. So imagine that. Imagine how beautiful the world would be if we, like, collaborated, you know? So, yeah. It's pretty important.
Jen, do you have anything to add or...
Yeah, I just had another quick question. Well, maybe not a quick answer to it, but I was wondering, I know it's important to have the discussions, and I know, you know, bringing it to people's attention is really important, but what are some other, I guess, more tangible ways in people's daily lives that they can take these sort of ideals of, like, you know, fighting away all the messages we've been given throughout our lives? How would you go about that, I guess? Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know what? I mean, that's a tough question, right? Like, how do we get people who, you know, live in a community where it's, you know, dominated by, you know, let's say white people, and everyone's very comfortable and working hard and, you know, successful. Like, how do we get people to leave their comfortable place? And now almost it's like we would like them to be open to, like, some negativity and anxiety. Like, how do we do that? That's a really good question, you know? I don't know that I have the answer for that. What I do know is that, you know, I suppose it's important for people to continue to have this dialogue. I think that when these same people who are living in their comfortable, you know, worlds, and that they're part of bigger institutions and bigger systems, you know, I think going back to what I said earlier is that if, you know, the ANTIO framework is, you know, brought to these systems and these institutions from the top up, and then really challenging, you know, these executive directors and these board members, perhaps then implementing these things in policy, bringing people on board to talk about their experiences, to talk about what ANTIO is. And I suppose we hope that those same people that then who are done their day of training, go back home, and, you know, we're feeling a little uncomfortable, and perhaps having the discussion with their family, and we're hoping that it was an opportunity for them to start that dialogue, or to now look at the way we're being bombarded with certain messages and maybe challenging them, you know. Yeah, I feel as though, you know, I think that people who dip into other communities, who get to know other communities, I always say traveling is really wonderful too, to see what's out there and how other people are living. You know, I think those are all really important ways to discover and to learn that the world is much bigger than where we live and where we put our head down at night,
right?
You know, so... Yeah, I don't know if that answers your question. It's a really tough one, but...
No, it does. It gives me some ideas, but yeah.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so. It's you know what, it is really tough, really tough. But like I say, I think, you know, government and all of these people in these powerful positions, I think it needs to start there, you know?
I agree. It's one of the things that I've been kind of trying to push for more in my program is, you know, we got to think, you know, beyond just thinking broad and general levels of policy.
There's right.
different considerations we really need to consider, right?
Right.
You know, my area of passion is the education system, and I often talk about, you know, there's huge gaps in there, and it can be a huge, impressive environment without, you know, including youth voice and the right to participation.
Right.
And, you know, we are telling children and youth what to learn. We're not asking them what they want to learn.
Exactly.
Right?
Right.
So I agree, but we are close to wrapping up, and there's so much I still want to talk about with you, but we have to cut it short. I do have to ask you one last question. We ask all our guests this.
Okay.
What does advocacy mean to you?
What does advocacy mean to me? I think it's a two-parter. I feel that advocacy, you know, perhaps the first step it's just like surrendering, like, you know, to ourselves and being comfortable, feeling uncomfortable. I think, you know, to allow ourselves to be comfortable in our own skin or getting to that place, to challenge ourselves, and learning about what's out there and stepping out of our comfort zone. And then I feel as though advocacy could sort of pour into some of the people around us. So in my position, very privileged power position, I try to step back and then really represent some of the young people that I work with in a fair place. And I feel that when we are comfortable with ourselves, we can truly advocate for others and their experiences, and whether it's difficult or not. But yeah, I feel like that we can definitely, you know, support people, you know, in their struggles when we are comfortable with ourselves and we feel it. You know, you almost need to feel things so that, you know, you can empathize with people's struggles.
I think that is a great way to end the episode. Would you like to say anything else before we end the conversation?
I don't think so. I would encourage to whoever is listening to this podcast, you know, to challenge yourself and to step out of our comfortable place. To listen to all of the wonderful experiences, and I say wonderful, and even when they're negative experiences that people have, you know, to share, I think it's wonderful that there's an opportunity that someone has some sort of a platform to share that experience, and then in turn makes people feel uncomfortable, and then, you know, with the hope that then we challenge ourselves and walk through the world a little differently. And yeah, take the risk, surrender, man. The stories that are out there, like, you'll be a much more interesting person for it, for sure.
Jen, would you like to say anything else?
No, I just thank you for letting us interview you.
Thank you for having me. I think it's really important. I think it's really great what you guys are doing.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks.
So Your Right to Speak will be posted on the second Wednesday of every month. Thank you again, Ian, for taking the time out to speak with us. It was nice talking with you. I wish we had more time. If you're a child or youth that would like to be on the show, or if you have any ideas of what topics we should be talking about, you can email me and Jen at yourrighttospeak@gmail.com. Let's raise awareness together.
This concludes this month's episode of CYC Podcast. Tune in next time for more discussions on child and youth care. Subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher. Visit us on our website at cycpodcast.org. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/cycpodcast.